Hi, everybody. I'm Beauty Cone Fredos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beauty Show. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about this morning after I got off the tennis courts was how important it is that we all have, whether or not it's a song, whether or not it is a mantra, of course, whether or not it is someone that we can actually talk to when we're starting to feel out of sorts. And the most amazing thing is that when I hear my music, the intro to the Ask Beauty Show, regardless of what's going on, if I've had a bad day or if there's things that are a little bit off track, as soon as I hear the music, I am now centered. I am feeling happy. And of course, now I am more than eager to begin today's show. So for those of you who actually may be tuning in for the very first time, I am a psychotherapist. I am also a sex therapist, and we're going to be talking about sex with my guest, Brian Gibney, a little later on in the show today. I'm also the author of the groundbreaking book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And this book was based on my research with 450 people. And I actually devised a fail-safe 10-step formula. I certainly wish that I'd had this formula many, many, many years ago, when I was starting out in my own serious dating life. In the formula, it teaches us all exactly how to assess who's right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. And it doesn't take a week and it doesn't take a month, but what my research actually found is that it takes close to a year to really find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. I'm also a national speaker, and I am so excited to tell you, I am the new advice columnist for Dan's Newspapers. So you can read my advice in Dan's Newspapers every single week. I'm a national radio and television expert guest, and I have a private practice here in very beautiful New York City and also in East Hampton. So what is the Ask Beauty Show really all about? Well, it is about empowerment. And we talk about all of the things that we can do. And of course, do is the word, not just think about, not just fantasize about, not just hope, but the things that we can actually do to improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. So we do. We talk about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships and how and what to do to maximize our physical and emotional well-being despite the stressors of life that we all experience. And my mantra, and I'm hoping it's going to become your mantra, is to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can the things that continue to get in the way of our lives and our relationships. And what I've actually hoped that I've convinced you over the years is that we don't need to take this journey on our own. And that reaching out to family and friends and if need be professionals makes our life journey easier and less isolated, alienated, and lonely. Because when you look at really what's going on in the country, in the area of depression, there are 17 million adults in the United States that are suffering from clinical depression. And, you know, there was a study recently that I read, and if this is an accurate result, this is good news. The study claimed that half of all Americans are actually seeking help for depression. I mean, this has never been my experience, but I think that these days, now more than ever, Mental health is really a subject that more and more people are talking about and more people are embracing. And that is all good. That is all good. And if we're looking at anxiety disorders, statistics tell us that there are approximately 40 million Americans who are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. And what is going on? What is really going on in the world of relationships? And you know, you would think that with all the self-help books and coaches and therapists and retreats and programs and movies about relationships, that we would really start to be seeing a decrease in domestic violence, a decrease in the divorce rates. However, if we're looking at domestic violence statistics, 4 women are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. And if we're looking at divorce statistics, the divorce rate for first marriages is 48%. And that number is 67% for second marriages. And what about couples who are marrying for the third or the fourth time? Well, couples marrying for the third time, they end up in the divorce courts. And a lot of people are really, really surprised to hear this. 74% of third marriages end up in divorce. So there are a lot of things that we really need to do if we're hoping to find and maintain and sustain healthy relationships. And I've actually identified three things that we do need to do if we ever hope to have a successful relationship with anyone. And the first thing, of course, is that each of us needs to be in a really good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. And we can't change our history. But what we can do is that there are ways with really good professional help to work through the traumas from our past and to be able to get us to a place in our lives where we're able to live in the moment without having one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And I think that a lot of us hope that if we just meet Miss Right or Mr. Right, that everything is going to turn out. But the fact is that we need to be solid. And as I used to tell my daughter Jordana when she was a little girl, is that the relationship needs to be the icing on the cake. And we need to be the cake. We need to be solid. We need to be in a really good place so that our relationships are going to then be able to add something to our lives that are hopefully really solid and really happy. So the other thing, of course, is that what I found is that with all the talk and all the books and all the movies discussing relationships, that we're still not really clear on the ingredients that go into a successful relationship. So we need to be students. And, you know, what I've been talking about for years is that relationship education is absolutely key. So there is a learning curve for all of us. And I encourage all of you to get on that curve today if you're hoping to have and find and maintain and sustain a healthy relationship. And then number three, of course, is my formula, which culminated in my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. And when you think about it, we assess everything in our lives, our cell phones, our mortgages, our computers, our cars. And yet when we think about being in a relationship with someone, we're wanting to meet somebody, we don't think about the importance of assessment. And there are many, many things that we need to find out about our partner before we'll ever be in a position to be able to say to ourselves, yes, this is a relationship that is really going to be good for me. So that if you're serious, I encourage you to read my book, and it will really give you a map that you will be able to use that will keep you educated, that will keep you empowered, and much, much, much more importantly, it will keep you safe so that there will not be, the continuation of, oh my goodness, I've ended up in yet another relationship with somebody who I really didn't know. And safety and making sure that you are not standing in your own way and that you are living your life across the board in ways that are in your best interest, that needs to be the goal for all of us. And if we're looking to other things that we really ought to be doing every single day to make sure that our life physically and medically and psychologically is in a good place, I mean, Dr. Gary Null talks about this every day, the importance of plant-based diets and fruits and vegetables and making sure that we are eating healthily and that we are interacting and socializing. I mean, that is so key. And having about 8 hours of sleep every single night and making sure. And there are a lot of things that get in the way of our being able to do everything on a daily basis that's in our best interest. But I think that we need to be mindful in every possible way to make sure that we are on a really positive path, and that includes exercise and weight training, and a lot of people like yoga and meditation, and just having supportive people in your life. And it's so important to make sure that we are eliminating toxins. And of course, when Gary Null talks about toxins, he talks about chemical toxins. And when I typically talk about toxins, I talk about the importance of making sure that we eliminate toxic people from our life. And that oftentimes, unfortunately, means eliminating friends and family. Some people will say to me, well, it's only a little bit of toxicity, but the reality is that a little bit of poison still happens to be poison. Other things that I've found and research shows to be really helpful for us, things like positive visualization and dancing and listening to music and getting out into nature. It can really make all the difference in the world. And another thing that I have found, and I know that my guest Brian Gibney is sure he's going to agree, is that helping others and giving back, it gives us so much. In fact, I've oftentimes wondered over the past 35 years that in the giving, I have gotten so much in being able to work with and help thousands of people. Other things to be mindful about when it comes to our physical health is eliminating sugar and soda and alcohol and nicotine, and really all toxins, so that we're wanting to live a life. And this is the homework that I actually give every single patient that I see, regardless of what the so-called presenting problem is. And that is that I want people to really be mindful every single day of making sure that we are living our lives in ways that are really in our best interest. And that's the homework. Is this good for me? Am I behaving in ways that are really positive for my well-being? Or on the other hand, am I engaging in interactions? Am I engaging in certain kinds of eating that are really destructive, self-destructive, or self-sabotaging. So in order to be able to live a good life, we need to be aware. We need to be aware when we start to get off track. And if we are not in a position where we have friends and family who can pull us in and give us that little bit of extra support that can put us back on a good place. Again, I think that one of the very best things that we can all do for ourselves is to reach out and ask for help. Well, today we are going to be spending the rest of the show talking about sex. And before I introduce my guest, Brian Gibney, who is a sex surrogate. In fact, in all the years, I have yet to interview a sex surrogate on any of my AskBD radio shows. So this is going to be a really interesting conversation. But I want to ask you whether or not you think we are doing well in the bedroom as a society, at least as a society here in the United States. Well, a Pittsburgh Western psychiatric sex study that involved 100 happy and very happily married heterosexual couples who were not in therapy, at least on a conscious basis, I want to tell you what the results were. Okay, so we're looking at 100 happy and very happily married heterosexual couples. So, what were the findings? Well, 50% of the women had difficulty becoming aroused. 46% of these very happy and happily married women had difficulty achieving orgasm. 15% of the women were unable to achieve orgasm under any circumstances at all. And what about the men? 33% of the men experienced problems with premature ejaculation, which, by the way, is a very easy problem to resolve. There are techniques, there are numbing creams, but 33%, that's a pretty high number. And 52% of men between the ages of 40 to 70 reported problems with erectile dysfunction. So just think, if this is what is going on in the bedrooms of couples who describe their marriages as happy or very happy, one can only imagine the sexual difficulties, and I hear about this all the time, that couples are experiencing whose marriages and relationships are less than satisfying. In fact, over the years, I've seen many, many couples of all ages and stages in life who rarely, if ever, have sex. So what I've done over the years is that I've identified 10 reasons why people have problems in the bedroom. And I found that unless all of these issues are fully explored and acknowledged and addressed and resolved, that sex will continue to be a major source of frustration. So I'm going to go through these very, very quickly. Number one, we need to be in a healthy emotional and physical state if we are planning on having a good relationship, sexual or otherwise. So that if we're feeling depressed and anxious and stressed and we have low self-esteem or eating disorders or lack of sexual desires, or substance abuse, or if we have been dealing or maybe not dealing with the early child sexual abuse traumas or religious beliefs, all of these affect sexual desire and our ability to really let go. So the old unfinished business, the old skeletons in the closet need to be acknowledged, addressed, and resolved as best as they possibly can. Number two, our relationships, especially for the majority of women, they must be healthy and satisfying if we are going to be able to enjoy a sexual relationship. If we're angry, if we're upset, upset, if we are disappointed in our partner, and if we have not dealt with our own intimate partner issues. Again, I have found that the majority of women, not only are they not interested in having sex, it's just really hard to let go. And what I've also been finding is that a lot of young women who are engaging in hookup sex, they tell me that they are so disappointed and they're so sexually frustrated, and they're not having satisfying sex. And my response to them is, why would you be surprised when you are with someone who you don't really know, who really doesn't care about you at all? And why do you think that a hookup would really care about whether you were sexually satisfied or not? So I don't know what you think about that, but that is certainly what I'm hearing from young women. Also, the sexual side effects of a multitude of prescription medications, including SSRIs, high blood pressure medication, cholesterol medication, and it goes on and on and on. And these medicines, they can really numb us out. So we do need to speak to our doctors. And it's amazing that a small change in dose and family of medication can really make all the difference in the world. And of course, the sexual side effects of alcohol and pot and cocaine, and these drugs do, and they can affect our ability to orgasm and also be able to really get turned on. And then if we're looking at the challenges of illnesses and physical problems, including cancer and heart disease and hysterectomy and pelvic pain, but the good news is that even if we're having these kinds of challenges medically, we can always touch and kiss and caress, and that can be the greatest aphrodisiac of all. And of course, there's menopause and hormone replacement for men and women. And of course, as women's estrogen and progesterone levels and testosterone levels drop, so does our desire for sex. And with men, as men age, there is also a real diminish in testosterone in their body. So again, it is so important that we be proactive and discuss these kinds of issues with our doctor. And, you know, one thing that I found to be really interesting is that in all the years, I have never, ever, ever had a doctor who has asked me about my sex life. When you think about it, it's amazing. Fortunately, my husband and I have a good sex life. But, you know, if I was someone who was having problems and I did not feel comfortable initiating that conversation with the doctor, the questions were never asked. So I encourage you that if you are someone that is having some questions, whether it's about hormone replacement therapy or whether or not you have questions about sex, you know, really give yourself permission. And, you know, during your next appointment with your doctor, with your gynecologist, with your urologist, with your internist, please bring up the subject. And of course, looking at erectile dysfunction, a lot of men will go to a doctor and they'll say, I want Viagra or I want Cialis, when in fact, the real question, of course, is there nerve damage? Is there some blockage? Is there depression? Is it performance anxiety? Is alcohol or drugs? Could that possibly be a culprit? So again, getting to the root of the problem is really important. And as I mentioned previously, with premature ejaculation, it really is a very easy problem to resolve. It takes a little bit of practice, but there is no need. There is no need for you to be walking around having an unhappy and disappointing sex life. And as the Nike commercials really tell us, you know, if you're waiting for the perfect time, if we are all waiting for the perfect time, it may rarely, if ever, happen. So the just do it Nike message happens to be a very, very powerful and very pragmatic way to begin to really Just get your sex life back on track. Well, I have a guest, and I am so excited to talk to Brian Gibney. Brian, welcome, welcome to the Ask Beattie Show.
Hi, Beattie. Thanks for having me.
Well, glad to have you. I want to just let our listeners know a little bit about you. And so here's a very brief bio. Brian Gibney has worn many hats in his life. He's a scientific researcher, an educator, a professional artist, and circus performer. Wow. And his diverse life experiences have exposed him to a wide variety of people and lifestyles and helped him appreciate the common threads that bind us all together. And as a surrogate partner and intimacy coach, Brian seeks to use his knowledge to help people overcome obstacles to physical and emotional intimacy, applying techniques pioneered by Masters and Johnson, and that was who I studied with. He uses a holistic approach to helping others find balance in their intellectual, emotional, and physical selves. And with the help of a therapist, Brian guides clients through the resolution of a variety of issues, including histories of trauma or abuse, social anxiety, poor body image, sensual awareness, orgasmic blocks, genital pain, disability, rediscovery of their bodies during and after transition, and late life virginity in a safe, non-judgmental environment. And Brian's practice is rooted in patience, authenticity, vulnerability, touch, and sometimes, and I'm sure more than sometimes, a little bit of humor. And you have all kinds of training. And of course, you've been certified with the International Professional Surrogates Association. And I am just so glad to be able to talk with you about your work. And many, many, many people knew that you were going to be coming on the show, and they had a million questions that they wanted me to ask you. So let's just start at the beginning. I mean, how did you decide, Brian, that you wanted to go into this kind of work? I mean, you were a circus performer at one point. Why the switch?
Yeah, it was one of those things where my life and my personal life and my professional experiences both informed each other. You know, in my personal life, I found that I was very often the person that people who had had traumatic experiences would go to, partners would often communicate to me that they felt very, very safe with me. And I came to realize that many, many of my friends and peers and other relationships, their relationships with their intimate partners were often challenging and fraught for a variety of different reasons. And in my professional life, I found that many of my different career choices satisfied a different part of myself. So my scientific research really spoke to my intellectual pursuit, and my art really fed my creativity. My circus fed my how I like to live in my body, but none of them really did all that simultaneously. So when one of my friends, who is a therapist, said, "Hey, have you ever heard about surrogate partner therapy? I think you'd be really, really good at it." You know, I'd never heard about it before, so I did a little bit of research. And it took me quite a few years to be able to wrap my head around the fact that this is something that I could do. You know, it's not something that you see in a career day at high school and say, "Oh, this is what I want to be when I grow up." But I do definitely identify as someone who is compassionate and patient, and really I want to help heal other people and help them have much better relationships. And I feel like this is such a wonderful way to do that. I really love giving back to people and utilizing the skills and the training that I have to do so.
No, absolutely. And of course, as you know, I mean, in the late 60s, Masters and Johnson, who I trained with, I mean, they used female surrogates to help men with erectile dysfunction and premature ejaculation. And I was just looking at some of their research findings before the show. And they were saying that 8 out of 10 were helped in just 2 weeks using surrogates. I mean, that's incredible. You could talk about this for years, and I mean that's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, the research is really amazing, especially when you consider looking back at what the effectiveness of just talk therapy alone was before Masters and Johnson started to incorporate surrogate partners into their work. I mean, long-term success rates were as low as 30%. So you're talking about, a 50% increase in efficacy. It was really a big groundbreaking thing. It comes back to how powerful touch is, how powerful relationships are, how we as humans learn. And that was really just the beginning, because while Masters and Johnson did a really great job opening the door and creating this profession, what we have learned over the past 50 years is that, it's of course all interrelated. It's not just about the touch. It's not just about providing touch for clients. It's
Right.
about providing a relationship model,
It's
really being a guide through their own self-awareness. While they sit in relationship with us. And that may or may not involve sensual or sexual touch. Some of my clients, that's not what they need. But what they really do need is relationship modeling. And what they do find is that when some of those messages that society has given us have been dispelled, they can enter healthier relationships, and certainly the issues they had around sexuality aren't that daunting. The issue wasn't the sex itself. The issue was the structure of the relationship.
Right, exactly. So what kind of training did you get in order to become a sex surrogate?
So let me start by saying we prefer to use the term surrogate partner, because
Okay.
that does emphasize the relational work that we do with clients, and especially since many people I work with don't get to sex, calling a sex surrogate is kind of a misnomer. It's not as accurate as it could be. As much as I love sex and I have a very healthy view of sexuality, it's not indicative of all the work we do. As far as training goes, that's a really good question. The model that most people think of when they think about training for a career is you go to school, you take some classes, you graduate, you do
Right.
an internship. That's not exactly how surrogate partner therapy works, because we are, as professionals, so informed by our personal experiences. So what I usually say is that the training that I did with IPSA was a wonderful clinical scaffold, a place to hang my life experiences on and say, oh, this is how they all fit together in a clinical model that I can use to help people. So my life experiences include non-monogamy. And how to negotiate and talk about that. My life experiences include sometimes exploring kink with partners and how to safely go about doing that and having a relationship to foster that. When we talk about the actual training that I went through, there is a 12-day training where we go through both the background and philosophy of surrogate partner therapy, but we also have training partners where we go through it step by step, and we live the experience. So we go through it as people who are both learning techniques as well as feeling in ourselves what it's like to have this, what really turns out to be a massive paradigm shift. It shifts our way of thinking about relationships and sexuality. And in that process, one of the things that was incredibly helpful for me was that as a group, we all sat down and we talked about what was going on. So when I had something that absolutely blew my mind, that said, wow, I have my view of sexuality and relationships has shifted because I have learned how to do X, Y, or Z. Other people might say, oh, you know, I felt that too. Wow, like I, as a man, have been taught similar things that you have been taught as a man. And we got to talk about gender messaging and scripts and things like that. So that was really one of the beautiful parts of it. The last
so do
part of
you,
training.
so let me ask you this, Brian. So do you find, I mean, I see, you know, a lot of people who have sexual issues and they have, I mean, I can't think of anybody that had made the decision to contact a surrogate partner. So they, you know, contacted me, you know, wearing my sex therapy hat, although I do a lot more than just sex therapy. I mean, I, you know, I'm a psychotherapist and I also have postgraduate specialization in marriage and family therapy and sexual dysfunction, you know, from, you know, McGill University in Montreal. But I'm so curious who your clients are. I mean, men, women, ages, single, married, who made the decision, I'm sure they did a lot of research, to contact you, a surrogate partner who works alongside with a licensed therapist, versus contacting, let's say, me.
Yeah. So for me, most of my clients come through a therapist that they're already working with. They often work with a therapist and they find that even though the therapy has been effective to some extent, they have reached a plateau in the work. That's because they don't have the somatic, the body-based component where they are able to feel and integrate the change in themselves. So the therapists more often than not reach out to me and say, hey, Brian, I have a client who might be appropriate for surrogate partner therapy. What do you think about this? Sometimes clients do hear about surrogate partner therapy through internet searches or seeing the movie, you know, The Sessions with Helen Hunt.
Right. Loved it. Loved it. Yes. Yes. It was a wonderful movie.
And then they will do their own searches and find professionals, practitioners who do the work. But I think that there might be some gender differences there, that men are typically encouraged to find their own sexual wellness and are motivated to find sexual wellness more so than women are. So they are the ones that will tend to reach out to female practitioners, and say, help, I feel like I'm broken. Can you fix me? Whereas, females often don't feel as entitled to sexual wellness, because we, you know, as a culture have not promoted that message. And it often takes the suggestion of a therapist to contact someone like me.
So do you work with a number of different licensed therapists, or do you work specifically with one or two?
I have worked with quite a few different therapists over my time working as a surrogate partner. I don't have one go-to therapist. The reason being the therapist is there for the client's well-being. They're there because they have an idea of what the client's history is. They have an established relationship with the client. So as challenges arise in the work with me, the client needs to feel comfortable with a therapist. The client needs to be able to say, hey, there's this weird stuff going on, and I don't know how to say it to Brian. Can you help me figure it out? One of the really important things about having a therapist is part of the relationship within the therapeutic triad is that a client has that ability. A client has someone outside of the relationship with a bird's eye view of how this work is relevant to the client's life outside of the work.
Are most of the clients that you work with, are they single? Are they married? Are they straight? Are they young? Are they old? What are the demographics?
So the demographics, my demographics are different than the broader demographics of the profession. As a heterosexual male practitioner, my clients have all been female. I would say, as a profession, the vast majority of the clients are still male, straight men, but they come from all walks of life. Straight, gay, different types of upbringing. It really is just about this is something that we deal with as being human. I don't think there's any one factor that I would say, oh, most of my clients are like this. We're all people just trying to figure out how to have good, healthy relationships and good, healthy sex life.
So if a man is working with you, let's just say the presenting problem is erectile dysfunction. So you would then, and I'm just asking the question, you would then perhaps be able to show him different ways that he could stimulate his penis. I mean, of course, that's having ruled out medications and depression and all kinds of other things that, of course, would interfere with men's ability to achieve and maintain erections. So would you actually be touching the men to show
Oh yeah, so
them maybe a better technique that they would then be able to get an erection?
this is a great question. Because let's go back to the fact that I identify myself as a heterosexual male. I don't work with male clients, at
Okay.
least if their goal is to move into sexual touch. First off, I think so much of the work has to do with establishing good awareness in clients, good sensual self-awareness, good emotional self-awareness, and then being able to learn how to communicate that. There's been a good amount of research done that says that, 85% of the work is done before there's any sexual contact. So I would not work with a man because what is really important in the work is that we both teach and model what authentic sexual interest looks like.
Right.
And because I do not hold authentic sexual interest for men, it would be really discordant for them to feel that
Right.
I was doing this as a job and not doing this with any kind of my own interest.
Understood, understood. So in working with women, so let me ask you this. So the woman has had sessions with the licensed therapist, and the licensed therapist and the woman, they've decided that you are the one, you are the next step to be able to help this woman really get in touch with her physicality, her sexuality. So what is that session like, Brian? I'm thinking, where does she take off her clothes, or where do you take off your clothes, and how does the whole thing really begin?
That is a question that I get a lot, and the answer is clothes come off way down the line.
Okay.
I typically see clients for a year or more. And one of the things that we do is we first talk about how we talk about our yeses and nos and consent and establish dynamics between the two of us that feel safe. Arousal doesn't happen outside of a safe context. I'm a big fan of Emily Nagoski and the books that she has written, where she says a lot of people are expecting to be aroused, but really they don't have a foundation of safety. So how do we create a feeling of safety when we're told in our society that we just need to wear lingerie, have a glass of wine, take a
Right.
pill, do all the things that we think should get us aroused when we really need to work on our relationships and how we feel in those relationships. So the vast majority of the work really is a parallel course where we teach clients how to listen to their body and know when their bodies are saying, I'm feeling safe right now. I'm feeling safe enough that I can be curious about the sensations that I'm feeling. Or I'm not feeling safe right now. And why is that? And then also teaching communication skills. Because, as a society, nobody is taught about how do we talk about these things. You know, how do we have authentic yeses and nos? So when a partner says, hey, do you want to have sex with me? Wow, that's a big question, right? There's a lot of feelings wrapped up in that. How do we parse out those feelings and then talk about those feelings with our partner when there are so many feelings about those feelings? Oh, God, this is someone I really like. What happens if I say no? Are they gone forever? Or, you know, I've had 30 wonderful years of marriage with this person, and how do I ask for something in the bedroom that I haven't asked for before because this is something I'm curious about? All the sexual shame, all the concerns about our relationship get compounded in those questions. So much of my work with a client is unlearning how we've been taught how to relate to each other, learning how to communicate well with ourselves internally and with each other. And
most of the people who you work with, the women that you work with, are they in a relationship with someone? Because I would think that if they were, the partner, I would hope, would know what is going on and would also want to be involved in some fashion.
Right. That is one of the things that we really want to look out for when we are talking about whether or not this work is appropriate for a client. When someone comes to me and works with me, I want to make sure that when we communicate, they're able to communicate with me authentically, and that authenticity comes from what their internal desires are. If they're in a relationship, they might be committed to something else other than what is happening between us or inside of themselves. And that has a tendency to muddy the waters a little bit.
I would think so. You know, one of the questions, somebody sent me a text last night knowing that you were going to be on this show. And this is what she wanted to know. She says, well, how does he go about separating his emotions from the actual physical act of touching? And I'm assuming with certain women that you're also having intercourse. So how do you go about making that separation?
Right. That's a good question. Remember when I said there are different things that make a good surrogate, and the actual training of becoming a surrogate partner really serves to create a container for the work. There are other things in my life that have prepared me for this. And one of it is that, like, I am good at wearing different hats. And telling other people when I wear hats. Whenever I walk around, I may be Brian, but I'm different parts of Brian. So with my daughter, I am dad Brian. With my romantic partner, I am partner Brian. Sometimes I am professional Brian. And this is something that we explore in a relationship with surrogate partner therapy itself, where in the beginning, I might show up more of as a teacher. And then as the work progresses, I become more of a three-dimensional human being, where my own wants, my own desires become part of the lessons that a client learns.
No, understood. You know, you mentioned that you have, you know, a romantic relationship, and how does she feel about your being so intimate with a number of different women?
So she absolutely loves that the work exists. It is amazing to her. She is incredibly supportive. And she sees this as something, as a gift that I give to the world. So there's no conflict there whatsoever.
No, that speaks volumes about you and about your relationship. And so, I mean, have you ever been in a situation where, you know, you really do feel an emotional connection, a sexual connection? And how have you handled that? I mean, it's bound to happen where, we people who are in the mental health field, I mean, sometimes we may find our clients attractive. And of course, hopefully everybody is going to keep to the appropriate, boundaries. But I mean, have you ever been in a situation like that where you were thinking, gee, this is someone who I'd really like to get to know outside of the office?
I don't think I've ever experienced that myself, and that's not to say that it doesn't happen because we are human. But part of the safe professional container is what this work means, right? What does it mean not just for the client, but what does it mean for us as practitioners?
Right.
And I like to explain it as, if anything, a summer romance, where you have this very set amount of time where you get to know someone, you delve deeply into feelings that sometimes change your perspective on the world and on yourself, and then it's over. And part of the work is dealing with what that feels like when it's done.
So, I mean, with a, again, these were questions that many people wanted me to ask you.
Sure.
So what percentage of the women that you work with do you have intercourse with? Do you engage in oral sex with? This is what my group of people want to know.
It's interesting how people jump to specific sexual acts when they hear about this work. And, as I go through the work
Hello?
With clients, are you there? Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay, great. It's interesting how many people who, when they first learn about the work, jump to a specific sexual act, because this kind of work is completely outside of the norm for most people.
Right.
And when I start the work with clients, of course, their brains are going in the same place. But then whether or not we get to the sexual act by the time we're there, it becomes a non-issue. It becomes a reflection of, hey, like this is something that I'm curious about experimenting with you. So I would say probably about less than a quarter of clients ever really even take clothes off.
Interesting. Interesting. I think that's a surprise for a lot of people to hear that.
I think so. And it might be different with how other people practice.
Right.
But even when I am naked with a client, we're dealing with things like body image and vulnerability. We are dispelling the messaging that nudity equals sexuality. So it's not even close to as salacious as what people think. It really is just like, wow, this is here existing in relationships in a different context. And a different context is we don't have any clothes on.
And so you say that about, only about 25% of the people that you work with will be in situations with you where you will both be taking off your clothes. So it's a relatively small percentage, and I think that percentage
right.
would surprise a lot of people. So that you're really the educator, the nurturer, the person who's giving people permission to be able to feel what they feel and experience what they experience and experiment what they want to experiment with. So it's more that. Is that right, Brian?
Yeah, absolutely. And because Because I am a male, typically working with females, the end of the work where sexuality may be on the table may be different for me than other practitioners. But what happens with clients is they say, "Hey, now I have the skills that I can go out into the wild, and I can have more organic relationships, and I can explore sexuality with people that I have a more real world emotional connection to than what I have with you." And that's fine.
Is the whole issue of surrogate partners, is it becoming, and I know we just have a few more minutes left, but is
Sure.
it becoming less controversial? Because I was looking at some statistics, and I'm not sure whether they're the most updated statistics, that there were approximately 75 surrogate partners in the United States, 20 approximately 20 are men. Are those statistics still reliable?
There are not a whole lot of surrogate partners out there because not a lot of people know about it. I for one have done a lot of work doing outreach to the broader therapeutic community talking about surrogate partner therapy. I think through podcasts like this, people are learning about surrogate partner therapy. So I think it is slowly changing. But the profession took a really big hit in the 80s and 90s with AIDS, with social conservatism, and it really is just now starting to bounce back. I think part of that has to do with this how we've reconceived of the profession using a relational model rather than just provide mechanical sexual services.
Well, listen, very quickly, Brian, for people who may want to reach out to you, what is the best way to reach Brian Gibney? For
The
people who
best
have
way to
questions? Yes.
questions, whether you're a therapist, whether you're a person who thinks that you would like to connect with a surrogate partner, my website is bgsurrogatetherapy.com, all one word, and you can just contact me through that.
Well, that's great. Now, listen, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show. You know, if the show was not just an hour long, I have a million more questions from a million more people who, would like to continue this discussion. We probably should do a part two. And again, I want to thank you so
I'm
much.
happy to do that. Thank you so much.
So listen, take care, and we'll be in touch, okay? And have a good
You
rest of the
too.
day. Okay,
Take care.
bye-bye. Well, everybody, that was Brian Gibney. Brian Gibney. And there are a lot of things out there in the world that we may not normally consider. And when I wear my sex therapy hat, I mean, people are coming with a variety of different issues and problems. And of course, I give people lots and lots and lots of instruction and homework. And yet there are times, obviously, when people need a more hands-on approach, and this is where the surrogate partner thing really comes. It's certainly a viable option that I think that the majority of people would never even actually consider. And that's one of the things about this show, is that I want to be able to talk about things and to educate, you and all of us about issues and subjects that we might normally have no knowledge about at all, that yet could be able to really make a positive difference in our lives. So, boy, this hour, it has really come and go very quickly. And I want to thank you all for listening, as you do every single week, and for your texts and for your emails, and for your, real letters of support. And I want to leave you with my two weekly messages for all of us. This first one, of course, is to do whatever it is that we need to do to live lives in ways that are in our best interest. And secondly, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to understand and learning to love each other. So goodbye, everybody. I will talk with you next week and every Monday from 3 to 4 Eastern Standard Time, and have a very good rest of the day. Be well and do what's in your best interest. Goodbye, everybody.